All right, right now it is time to bring in David Tarachuk. He joins us on a Friday morning live here at Robinhood Radio. We rebroadcast David again on Monday after the noon news and also during the weekend. David, by the way, is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has his own website, themediabeat.us, I do believe it's what it's called. Let's bring in David this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning to you. I'm reporting in to you, as usual, from the media capital of the world, New York City. Also this week, it would seem, the protest capital of not necessarily the world, but certainly of the United States. More protests here than I think in any other comparable part of the Union, per square mile, that is, allowing for our very tight square footage here in Manhattan.
Well, like New Yorkers like to protest.
Well, yes, they would often say that they have a lot to protest about, but that's a matter of opinion. No, but in this overall atmosphere of protest and outrage, New York City has, of course, just been playing the same part as many other neighborhoods and cities and states throughout the Union.
Well, we have in our area, every town has had a Black Lives Matter protest sit down, just saying this should now be brought to the forefront once again. America has been struggling against it's a systematic way of treating black people or people of color differently than white folks. And we even had one here in Sharon at the beautiful clock tower yesterday, which, and by the way, most of these demonstrations, which have been extremely successful up here, have been arranged by young people, which is great, who are actively involved in what's going on. And yesterday, about 130 people showed up at the clock tower on a moment's notice to signal their support for Black Lives Matters. And what I find amazing, though, David, that after this was over, I took some pictures and I posted them up on my personal Facebook page and on the radio station page. And there were a couple of comments, once again, that all lives matter. And normally you wouldn't take offense to that, but I think you have to look at all lives matter in a way like this, which I truly believe in. All lives matter once we can get the fact that black lives matter. I mean, it really, with our systematic racism in this country, because this country basically, folks, whether you want to believe it or not, has been founded on the base of racism one way or another. And it's just been tough to shake. And could this be the turning point, David, or not?
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, rhetoric is not a practice of logic. It's a practice always that takes full account of context and therefore of emotion. And while the phrase "all lives matter" may be an objectionable piece of statement of a general and acceptable, universally acknowledged, to use a good old 18th century term, notion that all lives do matter, nonetheless, of course, it has come to have a connotation which is in itself is racist. It's a kind of angry white response to the Black Lives Matter assertion, because of course the Black Lives Matter assertion has grown up in the face of a systemic way that this country has had over centuries of demonstrating and acting as if black lives do not matter as much as white lives. So that, the terms of the argument are very clear, and I'm afraid the response being used to your postings and and in rhetoric generally, from the right, and often racist position, when the cry goes up, white lives matter, and sometimes it's white lives matter too, is clearly to be seen in the overall context. That context, however, is apparently, I mean, I think there is a lot of evidence to say that it's in the state in a moment, rather diminishing phrase, but it's still, you know, it's a moment in history, arguably, when the worm is turning. It's hard not to believe that. The evidence is pretty clearly spread out in front of us. Journalism in general is reacting with a real sense that with this particular administration, especially its usual allies, the usual allies of President Trump, believe that he is on the wrong side of public opinion. I mean, it's becoming so evident. Trump's own, his administration's own chairman of the military chiefs of staff, General Mark Milley, apologizing yesterday for going along with Trump in that photo opportunity, which involved gassing and beating back peaceful protesters, so that the walk across Lafayette Park from the White House to the church, so the president could use the Bible as a prop for a photograph, is something that the top military official of the country feels he has to apologize for taking part in. Something is shifting, and at the same time, small things, well, perhaps not so small, but the mayor of Jacksonville in Florida, Lenny Curry, who hewed very close to Trump, And over the time since he got elected a couple of years ago, and has successfully attracted Trump to take the Republican convention, or most of it, from North Carolina to his city in Florida. he's the man who's changed his own mind and changed his own city's policy, and is taking down a Confederate hero statue. More and more the evidence piles up. In the Senate, a Republican-led committee, because it is the Senate controlled by Republicans, voted itself to remove the names of Confederate officers from military bases, the names of military bases. Excuse me. made a point of doing it in response to Trump saying that no way were army bases to have their names changed, even if they are tarred with that memory of a Confederate rebellion, a racist Confederate rebellion in many people's views. Trump is increasingly sounding like many things he sounds like, but most relevantly, I think, in this case, that he's sounding like a cultural relic, he's detached not only from the left-leaning protesters, of course, but also from the country's political middle, and even from Republican allies and his own military leaders. It's a time of great resonance, it seems, that many people who previously did not take this position are now seeing that things do have to change. And incidentally, it's a worldwide phenomenon. That is one of the most extraordinary things. You know, you and I have made a point in our discussions to single out good practices in the media, as well as doing a media critique each week. And my choice this week happened to be, even before some of these developments of the last couple of days, was to point out the really prime example of best practice in journalism from I'm not being biased in this at all. It's from a British publication, The Economist. When I lived in Britain myself, I was no great fan of the Economist. I think it has a terrible tendency towards know-it-all, condescending commentary. But this week, under its newish, still fairly newish editor, an English woman with the extraordinary name of Zanny Minton Beddoes. I think she was a Susan at one point, and the name was changed. But she wrote she has edited a remarkable edition of the Economist this week, and it's pointing out the global nature of reaction to George Floyd's shocking death in Minnesota, and the drift of her coverage is very, very clear, and it's a piece of editorial work which is very creditable. I mean, that's the reason I'm pointing it out. And it's dedicated, the whole issue is dedicated to what it calls the legacy of George Floyd, and makes the point the first obvious point is that Mr. Floyd was not famous. He was killed on a street corner in an American city, yet in death, Beddoes is saying, he's suddenly become the keystone of a movement that has seized all of the United States. And still more remarkably, she writes, he's inspired protests abroad, from Brazil to Indonesia, France, Australia. The Economist's, I think, very considered view, and we need to think about this seriously, I think, that the fact that large-scale social change is really hard. Protest movements have often had the habit of antagonizing the moderate supporters that they need in order to succeed. And the Economist's point is that now, Mr. Floyd's death holds what it calls the rich promise of social reform, and reporting articles throughout The Economist this week are reporting the fact that, not just opinion but factual reporting from many different countries. So there's a round of bylines that they covers just about every continent. Every continent figures in a dateline. Protests in places far and wide that you would just not have expected developing after an incident in Minneapolis. The resonance of this shocking piece of news from one city in one United States state is having all this effect globally. And it's good to see The Economist rounding it up and delivering such a clear and thoughtful reflection on the whole phenomenon.
You know, what's interesting, and I'm going to read something that was written by Barbara Chatfield Reynolds, a friend of mine, but she wrote this after the protests on the green in Sharon, and this strikes home to exactly, and it should explain to a lot of people why the term Black Lives Matter is so important. This is from Barbara Chatfield Reynolds. My 93-year-old mama attended this ceremony. Close your eyes and imagine walking in her shoes over her 93 years. A black single mother of three who started out cleaning houses and taking care of other people's children to working some 50-plus years at Sharon Hospital. She had to, quote, know her place, end quote, for far too many of her 93 years. Now she knows her place, supporting the injustices that she has seen and lived all those years. Black life matters. My mama's life matters. Stand proud, black women. That is an amazing statement. I've known the Chatfields my whole life, and I've known Marion really closely for a long, long, long time. And this is the story of a 93-year-old woman who still drives, by the way, David, and still is active in the community. And this is what Black Lives Matters is all about. It is about the injustices of police officers doing what they do to Black Americans. But it's about every Black American that has lived in this country. And if you walked a mile in their shoes, I think you'd understand why at this point in time, Black people have had enough, and they want changes.
Having enough and wanting change is a universal phenomenon, of course. And to go back briefly to the good journalistic performance by the Economist this week, the datelines I was referring to, I just checked back and saw that this broadly sweeping piece takes in datelines from Amsterdam, Johannesburg, Melksham, England, Mexico City, Paris, and Sao Paulo. And rather like what you were saying about Sharon, Connecticut, the part of the story actually comes back to England, you know, the Economist's own home country. It says even where police brutality is relatively rare, meaning England, of course, rural England especially, attention has turned to domestic racism. In Melksham, a small town in Wiltshire, England, 120 people gathered on June 7th to protest against it. So 97% of the town's inhabitants are white. It has not seen a major protest since woolen mill workers rioted in 1802. Just like Sharon, Connecticut, Melksham, Wiltshire, England, is a demonstration of how much this issue has gained ground. We will see what effect that has on policymaking at national level and internationally, and perhaps most fundamentally of all, with law enforcement and order keeping protocols in individual communities. It can't fail to have some effect, I would venture to suggest.
With that being said, I can't let it go. We talk about the New York Times a lot. The editorial changes that have happened in the Times over the letter that was published, really without having the op-ed piece, without really having been seen by the editor, finally wound up with the editor losing his job.
Well, he resigned. Yeah. Yes. James Bennett, this has been something of a lightning rod since he took over. He was determined to be provocative and succeeded. He certainly broadened the range of opinions that the New York Times would carry in its op-ed articles, as well as its letters. But in this case, he was absent in action, as it were. He didn't, as you pointed out, he didn't even see the piece that got published and caused so much negative reaction amongst the Times' own staff, and that protest against it was very much spearheaded by the Black members of staff. So a lot of weight was carried in by their protests, and it made the Times think again, look again, and decide that proper, responsible editorial care was not taken over that piece, and by which, you know, I mean, it just wasn't edited. It wasn't carefully looked through. There were assertions made by the senator from Arizona who wrote it, Tom Cotton, which in the normal run of events would be challenged by an editor, and he would be made to rephrase or ensure that he was citing supporting evidence for the contentions he was making. Opinion writing for the New York Times is not a simple matter of saying what you think. You have to give evidence for why your position is a supportable position, and that wasn't done in this case. And as I say, even to the point of the piece not even being seen by the man most responsible for having it published in the first place, the op-ed editor himself. So he's replaced. I think many people are a little disturbed that it's almost as if mob rule had broken out of the New York Times. But I think what it is, in fact, is an opportunity for the paper once again, and of course it happens many times, and even great newspapers make mistakes. And the Times has something of a history over the last 20 years of making big boo-boos and having to carry the can, and of course sacrifice individual members of staff along the way. It's never good for journalism when that happens. But on the other hand, I think in the long run, it is good, because at least it shakes everyone up for a little bit, and we remember what our basic, simple, fundamental duties are, and how we have to practice them all the time and consistently. And you know, the alertness that we have to observe and practice in editing guests' material when it comes in, it has to be every bit as rigorous as we would apply to our own staff.
It's interesting to watch the mainstream media now coming off this pandemic, which, by the way, is still a pandemic, whether or not states are opening up or localities are opening up.
Oh, indeed, and the ones that are opening up happen. It's not provable yet, but the fresh spiking of reported cases seems to be matching the degree of opening up that individual states have been practicing. So it's starting to look as if not only is it still with us, it may even be gathering force again.
And that's the quandary that now I think media has. You have to balance the other stories that are happening in this country and the world, along with the pandemic, which Mnuchin made a statement yesterday which has not been followed up on by a lot of media, and that statement was there'll be no second economic shutdown. And I think what newspapers and mainstream media can actually provide across the country is a certain level of comfort by noting that, no, maybe we don't need a nationwide shutdown of the economy again. But obviously, I think it's an important job of newspapers and media in general to point out that states and counties that are having these spikes have the ability themselves to go forward and do quarantining how they want to do to stop these spikes with the assistance of the U.S. government. I think those are stories that have to start to come out now, because this is the way it's going to have to be handled in the future. The United States government, whether President Trump likes it or not, is going to have to help states and individual counties fight this on an individual battlefront. And I hope media can get together like they've done with the Black Lives Matter and put that point forward to let people know there is a way out of this, and it doesn't have to be a total United States shutdown.
Yeah, the idea of a consensus around a contentious issue is a rarity, but it does happen sometimes. It may well be happening on the matter of systemic racism, and it may start to happen now when we begin to, you know, appreciate the full seriousness of the pandemic and its economic effect on us, and the kind of balance that needs to be struck that you're talking about there between carefulness and proper restrictions to stop the spread of a disease versus the need to keep our economy alive and well. And striking that balance is something that you would think, it's a dangerous phrase in commentary about journalism, I know, but you would think that people of goodwill could agree around some central principles in that. But instead, I'm afraid, what has been the picture so far in the United States is it's become another of these politically, culturally, it is said more usually, the expressions of the deep divisiveness that the country seems to be suffering. It's almost a badge of honor in certain kind of I don't quite know how to describe them, but people who want to put down the seriousness of the pandemic and even go out in the streets with a kind of bravado and not wear a mask. And indeed, you know, the topmost official in our country has declined to wear a mask himself rather infamously. But nonetheless, I think a consensus can emerge and may well be emerging now as we realize, as more and more people, I think, realize something that I think sensible people appreciated from the beginning, that a firm balance has got to be struck between firm and very restrictive measures in some way need to be taken about preventing the spread of the disease, while at the same time, you know, there are different ways of regulating those restrictions' impact on our economic life. Not every country in the world, for instance, although it has had severe outbreaks at times, not every country has shut everything down, and there are middle ways available to us here.
Well, all this is happening, and more is happening, and unfortunately, of course, what's right around the corner, really knocking on the door and with us?
I can't imagine what you're thinking about.
the media has to cover political conventions, and unfortunately, what that will do is it will politicize the pandemic even more.
It will politicize everything. You're, of course, quite right. It's the same way every 4 years. And sometimes it seems to me that it's the same thing permanently. I mean, the country often seems to be in a permanently political campaigning mode. And not a very, you know, and I think something close to that word nasty kind of mode that has got infected, if that's the right word, the body politic as a whole. But yes, it's convention season very soon, and then, of course, it's election day in November. I think we can expect things to get very much more heated and very much nastier.
All right, with that being said, we'll see what happens next week. David, we'll speak to you in a week.
See you then. Bye-bye.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio.